This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 146, where Chris interviews Gavin Barron about Visual Studio Team Services, recorded August 31st, 2016.
Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Microsoft Azure, Office 365, SharePoint, the competitive landscape, and related technologies. Just the information. No marketing, no BS. I'm Chris Johnson.
And I'm Andrew Connell.
Send us a tweet either to the show at MS Cloud Show or to Chris at LoungeflyZ.
Or to Andrew at Andrew Connell.
As we'd love to connect with you. We're just two dudes telling you how we see it.
The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by Valid.nl. Valid is a Microsoft Gold partner whose mission is to enable its customers to excel in their business through the innovative use of technology. Valid is always on the lookout for consultants, architects, and engineers. Do you know Azure, BI, and Analytics, .NET, Office 365, or SharePoint? Look them up on valid.nl. Morning, AC.
Morning, CJ. How are you?
Very well, buddy. How are you?
A little under the weather, fighting a head cold, but I'm alive.
Oh, stay safe down there in windy Florida.
Hurricane bearing down on us, but It's funny. There's some pictures that are floating around on Facebook where people are like going, everyone flips out around the country about it being a hurricane. And everybody in Florida is like, category one, let's go to the beach.
Yeah. You Floridians are tough down there.
Yeah. It's not a big deal. It's a lot of wind, a lot of rain, but it's not like an incredibly bad storm. If you don't live on the coast, if you live on the coast and you're right where it hits, then it's a big deal because there is flooding. But
yeah,
if like where I am, by the time it actually comes where we are, it's like going to be a tropical storm. So we need the rain. The worst part about the rain is that it floods the little preserve areas. And so the snakes come out looking for food. So that's the living on a preserve. I'm not looking forward to any snakes in my yard. So
yeah, you lost me at snakes.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm right there with you, man.
Yeah, freaky.
Yeah.
Hey, so today on the show, we thought we'd cover a couple of news items and then get stuck into an interview that we recorded with Gavin Barron about Visual Studio Team Services and continuous integration and continuous deployment and things. I know that we've spoken a bunch on the show about doing that in the JavaScript world and in Docker world and things like that, but we thought we'd sort of go and talk to an expert about who's doing this in the Microsoft world with VSTS, or what used to be called Visual Studio Online. And so we went and spoke to Gavin, but more about that in a second. Do you want to kick us off with some interesting news?
I've got a little bit of, I guess you can talk one, but one of them's going to be a little news thing, but I've got three things. One of them is an Amazon Web Services thing. So the end of November, I guess it's November 28th through December the 2nd, they have their big AWS conference called reInvent 2016. So you can get more info about this at reinvent.awsevents.com. But I thought that, you know, for, I know a lot of our audience is mostly in the Microsoft camp. So I figured, why don't we show you some, why don't I talk about some of the stuff that's kind of unique about this conference I found interesting. First of all, it's going to span across three different hotels in Vegas, between the Venetian, the Mirage, and Encore, which is one of the two Wynn towers. And if you know Vegas, I mean, those are really all in the same spot. The Venetian seems like the big one. That's where keynotes, the expo, boot camps, breakouts, certs, hands-on labs, hackathon, that's where all that's going to be. The Mirage has some breakouts, tech deep dives, and hands-on labs. And then the Encore Hotel has just got boot camps. So this whole conference for, what is it, about 4 or 5 days is $1,600. I think that does not include the hotel. But there are two things I thought that were really interesting about this conference, aside from the multiple hotels. One is that they've kind of gone out of their way to say that there's no open call for content or speakers. They've got everything planned. However, they are looking to set up like a customer-led or / unconference sessions so that people that want to submit stuff, there's no real kind of approval process that you go through. You're going to be able to submit stuff and kind of have your peers vote it up and to see if the content's going to show up, which I think is a really good way to do it. Another thing I found that was really interesting about the breakout sessions is that, you know, when you go to a big conference and, you know, Ignite's coming up, and I know this has happened in previous conference to you and me, but you want to go into a session and you come to find out that the session's full and you can't get in.
Oh yeah. It's the most infuriating thing, because then you got to go to your backup session.
Yeah, exactly. It's really frustrating. So what they've done is they actually have reserved seatings with waitlists. So just like when you at a normal conference, or like say at a Microsoft conference, when you would add it to your calendar, you can now, when you add it to your calendar through the AWS reInvent website, It adds, you have a reserved seat in that room. And then if you're not, if the room's filled up with all the reserved seats, you can go on a wait list. And so when the session starts, if people haven't shown up, then they can let people on the wait list in. So you know if you've got a chance or not of even getting in.
Yeah, Microsoft tried this a number of years ago and it was just a complete cluster.
Oh, was it?
Because everybody would add every session to their calendar and then just choose where they wanted to go and be tons of empty seats. And it was just a bit of a mess. So hopefully they've figured out a better system than the time I went to, I think it was actually I can't remember which conference it was. It was years and years ago now though. Yeah, we tried that a little bit, but it was a bit of a mess. But hopefully they figured out a better option, because it is definitely infuriating when there's a really good session you really, really want to go to and you're rushing from the previous one only to find out that the queue out the door and they've already shut the doors.
Yeah. And some of the venues can be tough to get around and things can just get all clogged. I remember there was a spot at the Ignite conference in Chicago last year where you went to that satellite building and you kind of had to do this weird, like kind of double back coming off the walkway.
Oh, yeah.
It got so crowded. It was so hard to get through that in any normal amount of time. So,
yeah. Interesting.
The other thing they're doing too is they have a little thing. It looks like this is what we would consider like a pre-con or a post-con. They call it the resource mini-con. And it's essentially a full-day tech deep dive on things like IoT, serverless, so that would be Amazon Lambda.
Yeah.
And hello, head cold. Databases, or even like a whole day just going deep dive on containers. So I found it to be an interesting conference. They're going to stream the keynote and some of the big sessions live online, just like Microsoft does at like Build and Ignite. So be interesting to see what the other public clouds are doing at that.
Absolutely. I will be definitely tuning into the news around that for sure.
Yeah. I guess another thing too, that this isn't really so much the news here, but Docker has been doing a preview. They started a private beta for Docker for AWS and Docker for Azure. And basically what this is for the Azure folks, this is essentially giving you a ARM template that will spin up a new resource group that's got a Swarm cluster, Docker Swarm cluster version 1.12 set up. You've got one, you can specify how many masters you want. You can specify how many workers you want. You can specify the size of each one of those. And what it does is that with your workers, it puts those into a VM scale set so that as the VMs get overloaded, they can kind of scale up and scale down. I went ahead and spun it up. It was pretty easy to spin it up. You have to apply to be in the beta. Then you have to give them your Azure subscription IDs to be able to have them enable it, which I found that to be kind of odd since they're just really just getting access to a template.
Yeah.
But it was pretty easy. I was able to spin one up, realize I screwed things up, was able to blow off the resource group and spin up a new one. And then right now everything is done pretty much command line because it's all Swarm. So you have to connect into it SSH and create your commands. Like Docker Compose isn't really there. So you got to do all the Docker run commands, which isn't that bad, but just kind of a little cumbersome. So.
Oh, interesting. I thought you could point your Docker CLI at that Swarm and then all of your Docker commands, including Compose and everything, would work against it.
You might be able to. Actually, I didn't realize. What I've done is I've SSH'd into the master, and then I was working on the master, but I never thought about actually connecting to it straight from my desktop or from my laptop.
I think you're supposed to be able to do that. I think you can connect. You can set your Docker Swarm as your Docker host, effectively, and then off your local machine, you're using that instead of the Docker VM running on your own box to send commands off to. At least that's the theory of it, I think.
I'll go back in and check that out.
Give that a shot, yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, it's not getting us right, you know, as close to where we really want to be, which is, you know, I don't really care about the infrastructure. I don't care that you've got three VMs or four VMs. If the VMs start running out of space, then scale them up. I don't want to worry about paying for each individual one. I want to pay for capacity.
Yeah.
So, but it's a step in that direction. So it's, I guess, as close to container as a service as we've gotten so far.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if they'll add that to Azure Container Services as an option.
That's one of the things I am going to go try and seek out when we're at Ignite, is to go find the ACS guys or find, hopefully, Ross Gardler's there and kind of find out, get any updates on what they've done with it and how they would kind of position ACS compared to this, because it really feels like Docker for Azure really feels like ACS, the Swarm version of ACS.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, well. Anyway, that's all I've got.
Excellent. So like I alluded to at the beginning of the show, we went and sat down with Gavin Barron, who's a guy I've known for a number of years. He's been in the SharePoint community for a long time. He's a SharePoint and Office MVP. originally from New Zealand, so a fellow Kiwi. And what we wanted to do with this is, you know, you and I have spent a bunch of time in episodes over the last wee while talking about continuous integration and continuous deployment for things like Docker and the new wave of node type apps and things like that are coming up. But we realized that a ton of our listeners are living and breathing the Microsoft world every day. And so we wanted to take a step back and go back and revisit, you know, what does this mean for a Microsoft developer and what options are out there on the table? And neither of us have spent a lot of time in Visual Studio Team Services, which was the newly branded Visual Studio Online offering, which brings together the, you know, what used to be called Team Foundation Server for code and source control and bug and defect tracking, plus their CI and CD tools and things. So we thought we'd seek somebody out who knew a bunch more about it than we did. And obviously Gavin has been working on a number of projects in this space for customers of Intigen, who he works for here in the States now. And he's spent a ton of time in these tools. And so we thought we'd sit down with him and really talk to him about what the world of CI and CD looks like in the Microsoft world these days, with specific regards to the Visual Studio Team Services, you know, cloud offering that Microsoft gives us. Subsequently, strangely enough, he motivated me to go and sit down and play with the tool. So after this interview, I sat down and signed up for an account and took a look through it. And it's not super, super simple, but it's relatively straightforward, I would say. Being a Microsoft guy, you kind of know where to go to do certain things, but the tools are quite comprehensive. So I got lost in the docs trying to find some stuff, but on the whole, it didn't take me too long to get a project from GitHub compiling in a continuous integration fashion and spitting out assets at the end, which I thought was pretty cool. So have you spent much time in VSTSAC?
I've spent absolutely zero time in it, but I was interested. I talked to Gavin at an event, I don't know, like a month or two ago, and he mentioned what he was working on. I was like, man, that would be a great topic for us to have on the podcast. So that's how we got him on the show, is it was something that, you know, I knew I didn't know anything about. And I thought that, you know, some other people, that it would be a good complement to a lot of the stuff that we had talked about all the CI and CD stuff that you and I do in outside the Microsoft world. So I know it'd be interesting to a lot of our listeners, or at least I hope it's interesting to a lot of our listeners. And I was very, very much looking forward to this interview. Unfortunately, I had internet issues when you sat down and interviewed him, so I had to bow out. And I'm looking forward to listening to your interview. So I'm going to be one of the listeners of this show.
Yeah, excellent. So without further ado, here is Gavin Barron. Welcome, Gavin, to the show. Gavin is a five-time MVP in the Office and SharePoint space, works for Intigen North America, is a Kiwi transplant in this great country, and developer extraordinaire. So thanks very much, Gavin, for joining us on the show.
Hey, thanks, CJ. It's great to be on the show.
So, like I said, developer extraordinaire. Tell us a little bit about your background and where you've come from and all that sort of stuff.
I guess I started out straight out of college doing a bunch of contract work for small businesses around the Christchurch region, automating their office processes, doing things like helping a plastering company automate their contracts for their contractors, things like that. Moved into web development, eventually joined Intigen and got tied up in this thing called SharePoint.
It sucked us all in, didn't it?
The beast is—it's an amazing machine.
So you focused on development in SharePoint for many years and things like that. What are you working on these days?
Not so much in SharePoint these days. Most of my SharePoint work has been, let's say, maintenance work over the last little while. Mostly focused on custom dev hosted in Azure. Lots of Angular front ends and C# back end type arrangements.
It seems to be the sort of the common thread these days, right? That more and more of our custom development is moving out of SharePoint into places like Azure and other types of backends and things. But is that kind of a trend you're seeing with your peers in the MVP world or in the SharePoint dev world?
Absolutely. To borrow a turn of phrase from a friend, what we're seeing now is more SharePoint adjacent development.
Gotcha.
We're building alongside SharePoint and talking to it from remote boxes.
Yeah, rather than sort of sticking tentacles into its processes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So today we thought we'd talk about Visual Studio Team Services and release management. So give us a little bit of background about your history with automating development. And you know, this is obviously a wide ranging topic that's kind of, I guess, for turn of a phrase, very topical right now with what's going on in the DevOps world and things. So for our listeners, why don't you give a little bit of background about what automated development and deployment is and a little bit of your experience with it?
Yeah. I guess let's start with, you know, my background in this and why I've been interested in it. Let's call me a typical developer in that if there's a process that's manual and involves repetition, I'm going to try and automate it because I'm a typical lazy developer. I'm not supposed to say lazy, I'm supposed to say efficient.
Efficient, that's right, that's right.
Yes, that's exactly what Excellent. I'm supposed to say. But in terms of automating stuff, I've been automating stuff since just after I left college. Got a friend who turned me on to a thing called Ant for building Java.
Oh, right.
Yeah, because I have a little bit of a Java background. And then early days at Intigen, I started using inAnt to, you know, automate our packaging processes off the back of builds. Turned that into SharePoint land. I was using a tool called Sake for scripted builds and deployments into SharePoint, taking what's a repetitive and sometimes very error-prone process if you're doing things by hand and automating it to reduce the chance of the human factor getting involved.
Yeah, gotcha.
I mean, we've all had horror deployment stories, right?
Yes, definitely.
Where there's been a manual step that someone's missed and oops.
Yeah, suddenly my release is broken and I've balked production somehow.
Yeah, production is not talking to me. Yeah, so that's kind of where I've come, how I've gotten into this space where I'm like, yeah, I'm very interested in making sure that getting our bits onto the servers is a process that is as free from human errors as possible.
Yeah, yeah, gotcha. So a lot of people, I've had experience with people look at this and go, that's awesome, but my release notes are like half a page long, really simple, and building all this automation stuff is really hard and time-consuming and all of that. Have you got any sort of messages for those sorts of people? What would you say to those people that are sort of hesitant, looking at it like, hey, that looks like a whole lot of work. I could do, you know, 20 releases for the same amount of work. Any messages for those sorts of folks?
Hey, if you're happy doing that, good on you. That's a fair point, right? Like, we're in software, it's a business. There's got to be a return on investment. But for context, the project I'm on at the moment, we're at, I think, 300 deployments into our test environment.
Right.
Since April.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're running continuous deployment, so every single approved build, green build, gets a push into a test environment.
Yeah, gotcha.
And then has automated tests against it before it goes, is promoted into any other environment.
Yeah, yeah. I also find that people are, they're really hesitant to do deployments unless it's really, really easy, right? And if you do have a really easy process and it's as simple as pushing a button or committing something or whatever the trigger is, that they're far more likely to go do the deployments. Otherwise, they sort of hold off and be like, well, no, hold on, we don't need this little change in there just yet. We could wait until we've got a batch of them, right? And that means you just find problems later on.
I make lots of small changes because that way you catch the changes, the issues quicker.
Yeah, gotcha, gotcha. So you've talked a little bit about automating development and the deployment process, but what would you say is the difference between that stuff and release management per se versus just the automation of those things?
Yeah, that's a good question. The difference is process. Release management is all of the steps I need to follow to get a particular set of artifacts or a build out of my source control system and onto a server.
Gotcha.
Right? And that's not just building the software and pushing it onto the server. It's, you know, getting sign off from the customer that they're happy with those features in test before it goes into production, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Do I need to send out release notes with a push into production? You probably should. maybe you don't need to with the customers you're working with.
But gotcha.
You probably should be letting them know.
Gotcha. So would you consider sort of automated testing as part of the automated development side of things, or the deployment process, or sort of release management side of things?
I actually think it's part of both.
Gotcha.
You have automated testing in your build process.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to run probably unit tests, possibly integration tests, depending on what your system is. But then when you deploy into an environment, you might want to run some load tests, for example, to make sure that still meets your performance metrics based on what those changes have occurred.
Yeah, gotcha. I see. So I guess it depends on which part of what type of testing and at which stage, right?
Yeah,
where it makes sense.
Exactly.
So this sounds all quite complicated. For our listeners, what tools are available? Where would you recommend they get started? If you're a developer building some .NET solutions or something like that for customers or an internal line of business solution, and you want to get better at automating your development and deployment process, what's on offer today, and what's the easiest way for these folks to get started that's not super frightening and kind of like, oh, by the way, you've got to swallow the whole apple without chewing? What's the first sort of couple of little bites of the apple they could take?
There's a bunch of tools out there. If you're a .NET developer, you've probably heard of Octopus.
Yes, I was about to ask about Octopus, in fact.
It's sort of the canonical release management software. It'll take the product of a build and push it onto servers.
Mm.
It's pretty easy to set up and get going. Visual Studio or release management also is really easy to set up and get going. After I'd been playing with it for a while, the first time it's daunting, right? It's not an easy process. But once I got to grips with it, I went back and tried to do a simple, vanilla MVC.NET deployment into a standard Azure website. A lot of developers would just go right-click, publish to Azure website,
right.
Call it done. That's really easy. Setting that up as a release management process, you could do it in about 10 minutes off the back of a build process.
Nice. And so that would be using cloud offering around Visual Studio Team Services, or are you talking about something on-prem?
Yeah, absolutely. We're running in the cloud. We don't want to be in the business of running those servers locally.
Yeah, that always seemed to be quite a hurdle for people getting up and running, is you've got to go talk to your IT team and go get a server somewhere, and then you've got to get some databases set up, and then you've got to get it all installed and configured and running with the right personas and all that sort of stuff. What's the process now with VSTS in the cloud and getting that up and running? Is it as simple as signing in with a live ID and rocking and rolling?
Basically, yeah.
Nice.
If you've got a VSTS account, I don't think the basic accounts are going to give you the release management bits, just because the hosts that they have access to don't have some of the bits.
I see.
I haven't tested it with a basic for free account, but if you've got an MSDN subscription and all those bits, literally there's just a new tab inside the Visual Studio Team Services portal. It's called Release Management. Click on there, go, hey, we'll create a new deployment process, we'll set up environments within it. Really doesn't take too long to get up and running.
I see.
The team's also got some really good guidance on the websites about some of the things you could be doing with it.
Gotcha. So what about, you go sign into this tool, you go set up your builds, I imagine, in there and go, hey, this is where my source code lives. Can that I'm assuming that can be in the cloud or on premises, and there's some sort of connector?
Yeah, you can connect with VSTS, you can connect to basically any Git repo, including the public GitHub repos.
Gotcha.
So, there's guidance on how to connect those up and get builds coming off the back of that. The way that release management in VSTS works is it takes artifacts, so a fixed set of files off the back of a build,
yep,
and pushes them out.
Yeah, gotcha.
So you can set that. You create a deployment process, which might have a number of environments within it. So I've got a deployment process for our test stream, and I've got a separate deployment process for my production streams for a couple of different reasons, mostly for separation of concerns and ensuring that we don't accidentally wind up with a deployment pushed onto our pre-production environment.
Gotcha. So you go connect it to your source, you go set up your builds, you go, cool, when you're done with a build, here are some steps around deployment for different environments. Like, take us through a typical deployment to something like a website in Azure. Is that as simple as, can it use the same creds that you sign in with to go, hey, here's my Azure subscriptions, or do you sort of connect it to the subscription you want?
And you then need to connect
gotcha
to the subscription you want. So it can, the VSTS instance or tenant doesn't have to know anything about the Azure subscription you're deploying into initially. You download a publish profile for, or connection profile for, that particular Azure tenant.
Gotcha.
Pull it in. So you can work in a couple of modes. You can work in release management mode, resource manager mode for Azure, or classic mode, depending on how you want to operate.
Yep.
And then if you're running in classic mode, you just have, there's literally a predefined task for a web deploy package into an Azure website. You just go, this is my Azure website. This is the web deploy package I want you to push. Go.
Interesting. So what sort of targets do they support outside of basic things like Azure websites and stuff? What sort of, how complex or gnarly can you get? And I guess you can script a whole bunch of things if they don't provide stuff out of the box.
You can. So one of the really cool things about the release management and build process in VSTS now is it's completely extensible. Hmm. You can, if there's not a task for something that you want to do and you can achieve it with PowerShell, basically you can write a custom task, upload it into your tenant and use it. Or you can just grab one from the gallery. So on that, you've got custom simple deployments push into a website. More complex might be, we have a pure Angular app that could be written on a Mac. It doesn't have any notion of a Visual Studio project file holding all the files together.
Right.
It's got a build pipeline in there. We have a build process that executes and creates that, just creates a zip file of, or a directory in our output, mm-hmm, of the artifacts, so the compressed, minified, uglified JavaScript and HTML. And actually, we use SFTP to push that onto a server.
Gotcha.
Which was a free, publicly available task you can just add.
Gotcha.
But then you can get to super gnarly and go full-on resource manager styles, get into ARM templates. So you can have an ARM template that describes your entire system, then keep that checked into source control, keep all of your secrets for your production environment. So, you know, things like database passwords, the keys for your Redis cache,
gotcha,
all those kind of things, and Key Vault.
Mm-hmm.
Have a script that takes your, connects to Key Vault, pulls in the production details during your build process, combines those with the ARM templates to create any new resources that are necessary. So this build here, we actually, you know, we added a new Azure service. We needed to add a storage account for this. So it's going to additively create that within the environment. So you've got a massive environment that's fully scripted and provision as you go.
Gotcha. So it sounds
very cool.
It sounds like it can be quite technology agnostic in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something, like you mentioned, you know, a Mac, for example, and is this something somebody could use to go with Xcode building an iOS application or something along those lines to go? Because right now, you know, if you build an iOS app and you're not using, well, even if you are using Xamarin, I guess, but just take Xcode-based iOS development, is that something you could go build a native app using and then sort of integrate it in with the pipe?
Yeah, there's no reason you couldn't. You would probably have to set up a dedicated box,
sure,
and install some bits on it.
Yeah,
I've actually read a blog post from a friend of mine who went through that whole process, doing a complete build of a native app for iOS, automated process to build the artifacts, and then using release management and Hockey app to push it into alpha users, out to beta users. Saw recently that the in the marketplace there is an app store task. So you can actually use that, the app store task, to take those outputs. Your alpha users and your beta users are happy. So, and they've given you a green light, and management's giving you a green light, so you can have that task to push into the app store to provide an update or a brand new release of your app.
Gotcha. Wow, that's pretty cool. So you can get, you could theoretically get total end-to-end automation into the App Store for your consumer app if that was what you were after.
Yeah. It's effectively the sky's the limit with this thing.
Yeah.
Because you've got a process that is fully extensible. You've got a really good ecosystem of tasks that you can use to compose up your processes already. And you've got whatever scripting you want. So by default, there's an Azure PowerShell task. So, hey, I can run PowerShell in Azure. There's a,
gotcha.
What can't you do?
Yeah.
You know, hey, if you're a containers guy, you could be spinning up new containers inside Azure. Boom.
Yeah, gotcha. All sorts. So I'm going to run a quick scenario past you. This scenario is not entirely out of the blue. It might be exactly our scenario. I'm getting some free consulting here. So we're a node shop, and our back end and front end are all running in Azure, but it's all Node with your React front end, Dockerized and running in virtual machines, IaaS and Azure, using Docker Cloud, which is kind of the orchestration and management of the container management stuff. So our build process goes, or our end-to-end process is developer write some node code, for example, in our API or what have you, in our API project, and commits that, and it goes into our dev branch. And we have Travis CI as our build tool that's watching GitHub, which picks up, it's a cloud service. If you're not familiar with it, it just sort of watches Git commits. When new code is committed to a particular branch, it spins up a new build process, pulls the code down, runs all the build tasks like gulp build and all that sort of stuff, builds the project. At the end of that, if a bunch of tests have passed and the lights are green in that build process, then it will Docker build that into a Docker image and push it to Docker Hub, which is kind of the place where all those Docker images go. And then based on that, Docker Cloud orchestration picks up the Docker image and pushes it off into those virtual machines in Azure and updates our development environment. I'm guessing the component we'd replace in that process is Travis for the actual build, right? So if we were to replace that with VSTS, it sounds like I could trigger builds off commits into GitHub. What about the actual build process itself? So can VSTS build node projects? And if so, where does that happen? And sort of what environments would that happen on? Do I have to provide the build box itself, or does VSTS online give me an environment to go, you know, gulp build those node projects?
So if you wanted to replace Travis with VSTS, yes, you absolutely can. There's a lot of support for that process, and I'll touch on that. But you can also go stay in the open source area and use Jenkins as your CI server.
Gotcha.
And from outputs from Jenkins, you can trigger release management releases in a continuous fashion if you so choose.
I see.
So there's a built-in connector for that style of working.
Yeah, gotcha. I've got to take a look at that because it's I'm not very familiar with the things that they've added for support around things like Node and that sort of stuff. So I should definitely go have a poke around.
But if you want to go VSTS, yes, there's out-of-the-box processes for Gulp and Grunt. You have to jump through a few hoops. The version of NPM that's being run by default is a little old, which is going to cause you some problems.
Gotcha.
And there's a couple of little hacks you need to do to update it and actually use the updated version. You got to set the path explicitly to the NPM that you're going to use. So you use the newly installed updated version, not the one that's sitting in the path variable of the machine that you're running on.
Yeah, gotcha. And the build servers that stuff occurs on, I'm guessing that's up in VSTS somewhere. Are those Windows machines, or do you get to choose what sort of environment they get built on?
Yeah. To be fair, I haven't looked into the cross-platform build options in the cloud-hosted scenarios. I think that you do need to go down the dedicated route and install bits for that.
Yeah, gotcha. So what are some of the, I guess, the good, the bad? We've talked about a bunch of the good. What are some of the sort of the bad and the ugly bits that you think people are going to stub their toes on or need to watch out for?
Yeah, the bad and the ugly bits. The thing that tripped me up first and foremost was building. You know, most people just with a CI build, they're looking to compile their code and run their tests. You're going to want to change your build process here so you're actually creating artifact packages off the back of that. And so the first thing you're probably going to want to do, if you, assuming you're building, you know, a .NET site website, you're going to want to make sure you're using a step that builds a web deploy package.
I see.
Because that's the easiest way of moving those compiled artifacts around. You're probably going to want to look at considering how, if you've got, if you're like me and you're building like an Angular project and you've got things like externalized resources on a CDN somewhere, so you're going to have to revisit your build process to make sure that you're covering those scenarios. Mm. You know, for background, the first project I started automating all this stuff using release management in is a big project. We've got four servers across two data centers for this with a .NET backend and an Angular frontend. So the build process got fairly complicated. So start simple. Start with just one slice of the deployment and then layer bits on. Everything that can be parameterized, put in a parameter in your build process. Those parameters are really useful. and because when you, as you build an environment, hopefully your test environment is fairly similar to your UAT environment, is fairly similar to your pre-production environment, is fairly similar to your production environment. So the steps that you follow to deploy to each of those environments should be, by and large, the same. So as you build out that first environment, everything that refers to a username or a password or a server name or anything that, you know, is going to change between those environments, use variables within your process to represent them. For example, we've got an FTP process, so we have an FTP password set up in our release management process. That's going to give some information security guy the absolute heebie-jeebies going, you've got a password sitting out there in the cloud. What? Chill out, man. It's okay. The team have thought about this. There's a little protect button on variables. So you click that, it masks out the variable. You can't see it. If you come in as an administrator, you can't recover it. You click on the unmask button, it's gone.
Gotcha.
In anything that's logging using debug logs, it'll pick up that variable as a masked variable, and all you'll see is star, 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 star.
Oh, interesting.
In the logs. So it's very well protected.
Nice.
So those are the easy gotchas. Websites. So you're going to deploy into an Azure website 9 times out of 10 with this. I don't know. That's my take because I'm a web guy.
Sure, yeah.
likely you're running an Azure website. You probably want to make sure that Azure website that you're deploying into has always on, turned on.
Gotcha. So it doesn't sort of go to sleep and then takes a bunch of time to wake back up?
Yeah, and actually fails the deployment.
I see.
Because, hey, couldn't connect to that in the time, so I just time out. But the next time, you can actually just click the button and redeploy that same set of artifacts to the same environment, and it'll quite happily do that, which is actually a really nice thing because that's woken up that server now, so that burnt me a couple of times. Occasionally, you'll wind up with strange network-related issues. They happen.
Yep.
As I said, we've hundreds of deployments using this now. I think less than 10 have failed in any environment.
Mm.
We've got 4 environments we deploy to across those hundreds that we've gone. Not all of those have gone all the way out to production. In fact, probably 20 have gone to actual into production.
Yep.
But most of them have gone at least a quarter have gone as far as UAT.
Yeah, nice. So I like to call this mean time to new environment, right? Where we're talking about environment variables and variables as part of your build process. And one of the really easy way to find where your code is not flexible in this regard is by creating a new environment and deploying to it and seeing if it works. So I like to call that like mean time to new environment. And an exercise people can go do is fire up a new set of machines or something, go do a deployment of your application to it and start the timer from when you start deploying your infrastructure, like the virtual machines or the websites or what have you, go create those. Are those scripted or are those manual? And go set up a new deployment target and go deploy to them. How long does it take you to get an app up and running? And in my view, I don't know how you feel about this, but you should be able to just hit delete on an environment and bring up a new one very, very simply and easily, so that you're like able to nuke your dev environment or nuke your integration environment and bring up a new one with as little pain as possible, right? And you know, being able to do that with a touch of a button means that you will do it far more frequently than you probably are today, and you will benefit from that. It's I don't know. Do you guys regularly tear environments down and bring them back up, or you know, just to make sure that you're in good and known states, or are you reusing environments very much, or you know, what's your sort of advice in that regard?
So, I would love to be in that space. Reality is, we're just not there. The projects that I've been using this on are, let's call them legacy projects. They're not really legacy projects. They're only 18 months old.
Yeah.
But when I started building these out, we hadn't planned for, you know, tearing environments down regularly. But green fields, and with the benefit of what I know now, I would absolutely have my environments set up in such a way that blowing them away is simple.
Yeah. I mean, with an ARM template, for example, you could be back up and running in Azure pretty quick.
Yeah. It can be very, very fast. You know, to explain to our listeners a little bit with the project that I'm working on, it was originally conceived and managed via Git deploy. Literally, we would just push our code onto the web server. It would kick off a build process on the web server, create a new set of code that's going to run,
and
push it onto that web server. And that was good. Life was happy. And slowly our build times and our deployment times got longer. We started out, you know, five-ish minutes, got a new website. Last time I did one, it took about 45 minutes.
Wow.
Partly because we'd scaled down from medium machines to small machines for hosting our website. So kind of something I like, I think, is actually what I would call a better practice in terms of scaling in Azure, is running the smallest possible box that gives you the headroom to do normal processing of your, your workload. Because we'd gone down to small boxes, we had to download all of our node artifacts, all of our Bower artifacts, all that front end built. And it was taking a long time. I had a couple of deployments where mysteriously the web config disappeared. So I had no website.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I was like, you know what, there's got to be a better way. Let's switch over and start using this release management tool to make sure that, hey, we know what's going on to each box at each time, rather than pushing code and letting it do its deal
on
the box.
Gotcha. Nice. So if I was a .NET developer, what's my simple 1-2-3 project to sort of get started with this? I go sign up for a VSTS account. What comes next?
Create a project in VSTS, so a team project. Use whatever template you like. I like the Scrum one. Some people don't. Personally, choose Git as your source control repo. Don't use TFS. It's kind of outdated.
Gotcha.
And as a reformed TFS developer, I have seen the error of my ways. Branches are good. Branches are not scary.
Gotcha. Nice.
So get yourself a repo. Get some code pushed in there. Fire up a build process. So, you know, say start watching against commits against your repository, and then have a process that literally just takes your code, runs it, or compiles it rather. Hopefully you've got some unit tests in there. Please, please write tests. they're the way you communicate to the developers in about 2 years' time who pick up your code and don't need to read the documents. You tell them everything they need to know about the code through your tests.
Gotcha.
Set up a task to run the unit tests against that compiled code. Set up a task to create a web deploy project out of that compiled code. Copy that into an artifacts directory. So that's sort of your basic four-step build process.
Yep.
Then go over to the release management tab. New build or release process, create a new environment, test.
Gotcha.
Pull in your connection to your Azure subscription in whatever mode you want. Pull in the web deploy task. Wire it up to the web deploy package that you just built in your build step.
Nice. And then go try your website.
Then go try your website, right? If you want to get clever, you're going to start adding things like, you know, a load test to make sure that your website is still within performance metrics. Maybe you're going to want to do things because you've got multiple environments and you actually, you know, you check in all of the web config transforms across your environments. So maybe you're going to want to do something like create all the web configs for the different environments as part of your build now. And then you're going to have a step that reads those web configs and writes them in as Azure website properties rather than burying them in application config.
Yeah, gotcha.
So you can go in through the application, through the Azure management portal and edit those properties on the fly if you need to. If you need to, you can set them up as connection strings so they're masked and not available for easy.
Yeah, nice. Well, that sounds pretty straightforward. That sounds something like I could do, so I'll give it a shot.
It's easy enough. I could do it, so I don't think you're going to have too many problems.
So is there somewhere that people should go to get started? Is there what's the sort of the website people should go to read more about this with the getting started guide and all that stuff?
There is the Azure Visual Studio Team Services blog.
Oh, yeah.
I would highly recommend that. But there's a really good series that walks you through a bunch of the basic stuff you're going to want to do as your typical .NET developer pushing into multiple environments.
Gotcha.
And there's actually walks through a bunch of different approaches you could take.
Gotcha.
So it's kind of useful.
Are you doing anything with .NET Core yet in this process, or is that something sort of a little further out in future type stuff?
It's a little further out in the future for me. .NET Core's interesting. It's down the road.
Yeah, gotcha. And sort of finally, where can people find you? Where do you live online? If people have questions about this stuff or just want to, you know, get in touch, what's the best place to find you?
The easiest way to get hold of me is probably through my Twitter, @GavinBaron. I have a blog that I very rarely write in. I should really get my game there.
Hey, you're busy doing projects. I know how it goes.
GavinB.net. So, yeah, either of those are really good ways of getting hold of me.
Excellent. And finally, I don't know if you've listened to our show before, but we do these sort of we do these picks at the end of a show, which are kind of like little interesting tidbits. They don't have to be technically related. They might be some sort of, we've had everything from household appliances to Apollo 11 launch manuals to code tools and interesting things. I've got one this week that I thought I'd quickly mention. And then if you've got one after that you can think of, sorry to put you on the spot, but if you don't, that's no worries. So mine this week is I bought a HD Home Run Prime triple cable tuner network connected appliance, which is I don't know how applicable this is around the world for non-cable people. They have over-the-air solutions as well, but it's for TV reception. So you plug this thing into your network, you plug your cable into the back of it, or they have aerial-based solutions as well. You can plug that in. And it will do digital tuning and TV signals over your network. So that means that now anywhere in my house I have a computer or an iPad or an iPhone or in my case I have a Roku 3 plugged into my TV. Now I can go get live TV signals on all of those devices. And then HD Home Run have come out with a new thing called the HD Home Run DVR software. So it'll do like recording of those things using guide data onto either a NAS device or a PC or something along those lines. And my goal was to get rid of my cable box and give it back to my cable provider and drop down to basically the cheapest cable option I could get, which was like $13 a month basic cable service. And so now I can watch live TV, I can record things and watch them on anywhere in my house. And then I plug that into Plex, and so now I can watch my TV from anywhere in the world. So I log into my Plex box, or log into Plex over the internet. I can watch those live TV channels or recorded shows, as well as any other Plex content I have. So that was my little weekend project at home.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, it was pretty nerdy. It's definitely The wife acceptance factor is undecided quite yet, but I will report back on that.
So you can get free over-the-air television via the internet now from anywhere in the world.
Correct.
That's amazing. So you could be, for example, down in New Zealand visiting folks or doing a conference down there and watching the Seahawks game without having to go through some dodgy proxy.
That is the exact scenario I was aiming for. Like, really, the only reason we ever watch live TV is to watch a Seahawks game now. Most of it's all DVR'd or on demand, right? But Seahawks games, it's still quite hard to watch football live over the internet. So yeah, that's why we have, that's really the only live TV we watch.
That's awesome.
Any picks off the top of your head for you that that you've either installed at home or use in your work, your daily work life that you think people would find interesting?
You know what? I've got two for you. One is called InCrunch.
InCrunch.
Yep.
Okay.
It's a plugin for Visual Studio. It's $150 for a developer license. But what it is a parallel test, continuous test runner. So if you're a .NET coder and you're writing all your unit tests and everything in Visual Studio, then as you save changes to your project, it will work out which tests have been impacted and automatically execute them in parallel in the background. So you could have, you know, 6 or 7 tests running as you're typing, which is fantastic.
Nice. That's pretty cool. So it's sort of all on the fly.
And it gives you nice code coverage throughout your indicators throughout your code. So really good productivity tool.
Very smooth. That looks like that's a good one.
It's very cool. Can be a bit tricky if you've got a lot of integration tests. Really, it is suited to a pure unit test scenario, but hey, it still helps.
Gotcha.
And the other one's actually geeky but fun, codefights.com.
Codefights, okay.
So basically, people put up challenges on the internet and you try and solve them.
Interesting. And you got to sort of race the clock with other people or something, or you get points for...
Yeah, it's essentially that. You get points for the completeness of solution. There's a time limit that a fight's available for. It's just kind of a nice way of stepping away from the day-to-day project work and getting more back to just the craftsmanship of software, thinking about how we do things and, you know, just problem solving in the abstract fashion.
Gotcha.
That's what I like about it. I don't know, I'm kind of... I like the craftsmanship aspect of software. The, I don't know if you've ever come across Conway's Game of Life.
No.
Oh, it's a great thought experiment. I'll let you Google that one up. Really cool to just try and solve that in different ways, putting different constraints on yourself as a different thing. Just
very cool.
The art of software as a means of relaxation.
Very nice. Well, that'd be super interesting. I will check them both out. So thanks very much for coming on the show today, Gavin. I hope people have enjoyed the show, obviously, and learned a bunch about Visual Studio Team Services and release management out there in the wild. It's not as scary and daunting as some would think. You can find Gavin at Gavin Barron on Twitter or gavinb.net. And thanks again for coming on the show. It's been great having you.
No, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show, and we'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or MP3 and provide us a link so we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is an excerpt from Evaporated Eric by Monk Turner, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find show notes for each episode. You can also find us on Facebook searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading to our website and entering your email to interact with us. Participate in upcoming interviews and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.